This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Down to Business. My name is Jeff, and I'm recording this episode from the Mind's Eye studio just outside St. Louis in Belleville, Illinois. In today's episode, we'll explore a variety of stories from some of my favorite business publications, including Fast Company, Fortune, and Forbes. So settle in. It's time to get down to business. Today's first article is from Fast Company magazine, entitled How to Learn to Work with Your New AI Coworker. AI will undoubtedly become a bigger presence in your working life over the next few years. In fact, it already is, even without you knowing it. According to a recent study by Gallup, nearly all Americans, 99% in fact, use products that involve artificial intelligence features, but 64% don't even realize it. Our current level of AI use may seem subtle and harmless. Think virtual assistants, navigation apps, or weather forecasting websites. But the speed of new technology is fast, and the promises it holds for transforming our work are too tempting for many companies to pass up. Like it or not, no matter what your industry, AI is likely going to be your new coworker. So how can we adapt to work with AI rather than training it to replace us? On the most recent episode of The New Way We Work, I spoke to Nigel Vaz, the CEO of Public Sapient, a consultancy focused on digital transformation. Vaz has been helping companies adapt to new technology for decades and sees both parallels and significant differences between our current AI transition and the dot-com boom of the 1990s. How this time is different. Vaz points out that when the internet first started to change businesses, many leaders were skeptical that it would have a big impact. E-commerce sales accounted for such a small percent of overall sales, for example, and it took 20 years for the shift to fully take place. Now, he says, leaders remember how transformational the internet was and are more eager to embrace the changes that AI will bring. The difference this time around is everybody's interested in what is AI? How is AI going to manifest? What does it mean for my business, he says. But there is a recognition that it could be a significant driver. He also notes that the speed of change is much faster now than it was before. We are really asking organizations and people to evolve the way they work on an exponential basis, he says. How employees and leaders can adapt. The technological transformation is the easy part, Vaz says. It's the people transformation alongside the technological transformation that's the hard part. So how can employees and leaders adapt to the speed of tech's advancements? Vaz says that the average person can and should tune out all of the discussions around chip development and instead focus on the applications themselves and what problems they help solve and what data they are trained on. He advises that companies should look at the needs and see if general AI tools can help or if they need customized tools. Learn, unlearn, and relearn. So what about employees who are afraid of losing their jobs to AI? Vaz says that the nature of work is ever-evolving, and it's not the ability to perform tasks that make an employee valuable. It's their ability to learn. If you obsess about what you know, you are always fundamentally going to be less valuable to an organization. I think what you have to obsess about is your ability to learn, he says. He uses the expression learn, unlearn, and relearn. The single biggest gift an organization can give you, and that you can give yourself, is this mindset that we value. What we value is your ability to adapt and to learn and to evolve as things are evolving, he says. Our next article from Fast Company, Gen Z isn't worried about China having access to their data. They should be. With TikTok and DeepSeek, young people are forking over sensitive personal data to the Chinese government. We should be worried. Among Gen Z, there's a certain nihilism about China's access to American data. Some argue that they have nothing to hide. Others say that if American billionaires can access their data, why not let China too? When TikTok momentarily shut down, young people ran to Red Note, a Chinese alternative, as a not very veiled middle finger to the U.S. government. China's threat over our data security is difficult to comprehend. If they were accessing sensitive information, we wouldn't see it. And for young people not yet in the workforce, their privacy concerns may be decades away. But we should take this threat seriously. China isn't some victimless entity to hand over your data to. Knowing that the world's largest police state is collecting your data should make anyone nervous. James Lewis, a researcher at the Center for International and Strategic Studies, writes in an email, China's laws say that any and all Chinese companies must turn over data if MSS ask for it, and there is no appeal or refusal. The domestic capitalist versus the foreign autocrats. Many Americans aren't thrilled with who has access to their data already. Elon Musk, whose Department of Government Efficiency has effectively taken a buzzsaw to the federal bureaucracy, holds gobs of sensitive user data through X. The same goes for Mark Zuckerberg and his portfolio at Meta. So why should we care about China having that data as well? But there's a difference between domestic and foreign data ownership. The United States has a court system users can fight through if their data is misused. If China abuses your data, there's no recourse. Moreover, the Chinese government and America-based companies have completely different incentives. Musk and Zuckerberg have a lot of money, but China's rulers have 1,000 times more, plus an army and nuclear weapons, Lewis writes. They're individuals. The Chinese Communist Party, or CCP, is a huge institution that will do anything to maintain the party's control. China has also committed dozens of documented human rights abuses. Bill Drexel, a fellow at the Center for New American Security, says it's entirely possible the CCP is using America data to fuel their abuses of power. Shipping off our data to China helps strengthen and augment their techno-authoritarian governments, he argues. Those companies are part of an ecosystem that is actively engaging in genocide, Drexel says. Yes, Facebook is not my favorite company, but it doesn't have Uyghurs in labor camps. Chinese ownership of American personal data feels like a victimless crime. We'd likely never see its usage, given how secretive China data collection process is. Drexel says that experts are even wary of saying what they know, given how quickly the CCP can patch holes. That means we don't even know if the abuse is happening at all. Much of the conversation around a TikTok ban covered how China could access American data, not that they are. But there are signs, Lewis says. The CCP is addicted to collecting data, having done so through health insurance companies, airlines, travel agents, and federal offices since 2014. True, America has the Foreign Information Surveillance Act, which allows the government to collect foreign intelligence information through means such as electronic surveillance and physical searches. But he writes, compared to the CCP's operation, that law looks like a chihuahua. The greatest threat of China's data abuse is a pluralistic in nature. The fear, basically, is that the CCP can effectively mine the data of millions of Americans for value. But that's not to say some individuals aren't especially vulnerable. Those in military intelligence roles are especially wary of China's data overreach, Drexel notes. But more working professionals should be cautious. It's conceivable that if you're in a business role that has a significant national competitive dimension, they could use it there too, he says. China has been extremely effective at corporate espionage and IP theft. You can see this data coming into the service of that. That puts young people in an especially blind position. Most have yet to reach high-ranking military status or climb to the top of the corporate ladder. Why would China care about the data of a random high school student? But that teenager scrolling Red Note or treating DeepSeek like a therapist could enter a sensitive industry in the decades to come. Meanwhile, the CCP is building their leverage. Lewis calls data privacy preventative, trying to cut out foreign data abuse at the root. But Americans are notoriously bad at valuing forward-looking policy. Just look at climate change. While many Americans claim to care about the issue, it remains low on their priorities because it is so far away. But we should want to protect our future selves, especially from the whims of a foreign competitor, with which there is no legal fallback. Drexel puts it bluntly, the CCP isn't interested in you until they are. Our next article from Fast Company, how to reclaim hours by cutting out the biggest time sucks of your workday. There's one scarce resource that nearly everyone wishes they had more of: time. It always seems like there are more things to do than hours in the day. Many ways to squeeze more productivity out of your workday may leave you feeling burnt out, but there are ways to trim the time spent on many aspects of life that will leave you with at least a little more wiggle room. Here are a few strategies. Create a guide to reduce interruptions. If you often lose hours responding to emails and Slack messages asking different versions of the same question, create an FAQ document with the answers all in one place. If you want to take it one step further, you can follow the lead of former Google Vice President and Stripe COO Claire Hughes, who created a Working with Claire guide. It's basically a reference manual to instruct people you work with. Fast Company writer Stephanie Voza explains in her guide, Hughes Johnson sets expectations such as how to share information with her and the amount of time she needs to send a response. It also includes her preferences, styles, and approaches, as well as alternative sources for help when employees are in a pinch and can't move forward. Next, trim all your meetings by at least 10 minutes. Yes, many people think all meetings are a waste of time, and while some companies have taken the extreme approach of eliminating all recurring meetings, many meetings are necessary and help build and maintain relationships. However, very few of us fully pay attention for the entire length of a meeting, especially remote meetings. In fact, LiveCareer found that 9% of people start losing focus in less than 10 minutes into a meeting, while 43% said they lasted 20 to 30 minutes. Only 4% of people said they stayed focused for an hour or more. Knowing that attention and therefore usefulness drops off after 20 minutes, trim the meetings you have control over. Half-hour meetings become 20 minutes, hour-long meetings become 40 minutes, and by the end of the week, you've reclaimed several hours. Do it now or delegate it. To-do lists are a great productivity and organizational tool, but we all waste a lot of time accumulating and then coming back to small tasks that end up eating up more time than they're worth. Vladislav Podolako, founder and CEO of Folderly, uses what he calls touch it once or TIO principle. Here's how it works for him. If you can do a task in 10 minutes or less, I do it right away. If not, I either delegate it to someone else or I set it aside for at least a week. Podolakio uses emails as a perfect example, explaining that many of the emails he retrieves require quick decisions. If I'm just BCC'd, usually my action is no action at all. If I know someone who knows an answer better, I forward the email. He adds that that saves time by focusing on being helpful instead of crafting a beautiful-looking but useless email. Again, reading from Fast Company magazine, nostalgic buttery yellow is about to be everywhere. The retro hue evokes comforting baked goods in your grandma's 1960-era kitchen. KitchenAid just unveiled its color of the year, a retro comforting buttery yellow. While most people are aware of Pantone's color of the year program, Hello Mocha Mousse, fewer might be clued into the fact that the beloved appliance company KitchenAid has been running its own version of the concept since 2017. Each year, KitchenAid picks a trendy new hue to outfit a line of its iconic stand mixers. In 2023, the pick was an electric pink hibiscus, followed by a powdery blue salt in 2024, and now the company is all in on its nostalgic buttery hue. The new mixer retails online for $499.99. A team of analysts from KitchenAid's parent company, Whirlpool, work year-round to identify culturally relevant colors for new products. The Color of the Year program is a way to highlight that work, and conveniently, it taps into the consumer demand for colorful cookware that has helped brands like Our Place and Le Creuset amass loyal followings. Brittany Purchase is a color material and finish designer at Whirlpool. She says her team has had their eye on yellow for the color of the year since 2019, when mustard first started becoming a popular hue. The main goal with the Color of the Year program is to look at the drivers of social cultural trends and filter those through the KitchenAid brand lens. Then we forecast how people may want to feel in the year of launch. In this case, those feelings were comfort and optimism. From there, we look at our color tracking to identify which tones seem to be emerging and which align best with interior design trends. Buttery yellow is an apt choice, given that the soft retro hue is having something of a modern-day revival. Back in December, Pinterest predicted that 2025 would see a resurgence of youthful primary colors in interior design. In January, the platform spotlighted butter yellow as one of its five colors of the year. Given that searches for butter yellow on the site were up 115%, while butter yellow nails saw intense spike by 1,835%. Purchase team identified their perfect butter yellow shade by collecting a range of potential samples, including a vintage butter knife found in an antique shop. The final hue is somewhat brighter than plain butter, but it's just right to evoke the warm and fuzzy feelings of your grandma's 1960-era kitchen. Butter is so comforting, yet indulgent. The soft color has just enough energy to spark that feeling of joy. We literally wrote a love letter to butter as we were building our inspiration around this year's selection. Again from Fast Company, work-life balance is a myth. Here's why I practice intentional intensity. The wellness market is the biggest it has ever been, with a valuation of nearly $2 trillion, according to a McKinsey report. But somehow today's workforce is more burnt out than ever before. Research by the Boston Consulting Group shows that 48% of workers are exhausted from stress. The reason? Wellness works, but the way we are working doesn't. After spending a decade on Wall Street, I can attest that high stress periods at work are inevitable. Unfortunately, anyone advocating for better stress management often receives an eye roll due to the misconception that it means avoiding stress altogether. When I learned that stress management is not about removing stress, but about managing my energy, everything changed. Can stress be good? Stress is a natural response to stimuli that is not innately good or bad. It can actually be positive in a corporate setting because it pushes us to meet a deadline or grow a skill set beyond our comfort zone. That's why so many of us perform well under pressure. The human stress response, also known as fight or flight response, activates adrenaline and cortisol. In moderation, this is helpful for accomplishing defined, urgent tasks. Stress becomes negative when we engage our fight or flight response for prolonged periods of time. This leads to an exhausted nervous system and potential career burnout. Once we complete a high-stress assignment, we need to shift into a less taxing, energetic state. The key here is to make sure that you're not spending your entire life in a high-stress state. Not all work tasks need to be stressful. Activities like sending low-stakes emails or catching up with coworkers, for example, can actually be enjoyable and even restorative. You need to signal to your body when you've completed a stressful event. This way, you can restore yourself and conserve your energy for the next high-pressure stint. Over my career on Wall Street and now as the founder of a corporate wellness consultancy and community called Wall Street Wellness, I've found that each person moves through three distinctly different but equally important energetic states during the day. By labeling and recognize them, a person can start to move between them more intentionally. The most demanding energetic state? Intentional intensity. This is when you're in your peak performance zone. I call this the state of intentional intensity, which is when you mindfully leverage your stress response for optimal performance and productivity in order to complete a time-bound objective. I personally try to only call upon intentional intensity during periods where I have tight time constraints and high stakes. These moments happen multiple times a day when I worked in client-facing roles in investment banking and private equity. But because I was able to repair and recover after I finished my tasks, I avoided burnout throughout the workday. Sprinting through spurts of intentional intensity allows a person to access their most efficient and best work. However, given the toll that stress puts upon the nervous system, you should only leverage this state when you really need it. The neutral energetic state, relaxed productivity. After completing a high-stress stake, I recommend downshifting into the second defined state of relaxed productivity. You still need to be productive, but you don't need to use 100% of your mental and energetic capacity. Examples of this type of work include preparing materials for a non-urgent meeting, doing systematic analysis work, or any type of task that gets you into a flow state. These lower intensity types of tasks allow more space to add in restorative elements that bring us joy, whether that's listening to a favorite playlist, stretching to release tension, or taking a coffee break with a favorite coworker. Ideally, when we become more mindful about what our tasks truly require, we can spend a good portion of our working time in a state of relaxed productivity. I distinctly remember taking an inventory of my tasks in finance and being surprised to find that I can make most tasks relaxing, though intentionally shifting into this style of work. The least demanding energetic state? Restorative time. Restorative time is the third energetic state and describes periods where you can fully detach from work tasks. This might look like going to the gym, cooking a nutritious dinner, or spending time with friends and loved ones. It's essential to ensure that you've built in every day, even if it's 5 minutes, screen-free walk, or a short call with a loved one. Doing this allows for a mental reset, which creates more energy and excitement to return to the work environment. In the same way that having too much intentional intensity can cause burnout, having too few instances of restorative time can have the same effect. How best to shift between energetic states? Stress management comes from mastering the ability to mindfully transition between these three energetic states. In a work setting, it can be easy to continue staying high intensity even when you don't need to be there. To transition to another energetic state, it's helpful to have a physical or sensory experience that signals to your brain that it's time to switch things up. Some people may find it helpful to do some breath work or even go for a short walk after finishing a stressful deliverable. Other people might have a special playlist for focus time and another for productivity and rest. The more signposts you can create for your body that you're changing energetic states, the better. These give your nervous system the clear message that it's no longer in danger and can relax and begin recharging. Burnout doesn't come from working hard. It comes from working too long in a more intense state without taking the necessary time to recharge. Remember, the brain is like a muscle. It needs time to rest and repair. Mastering the ability to switch between energetic and stressful states is the key to achieving peak performance and career longevity. This insight was the great unlock in my own career that changed everything. Ultimately, the key to managing burnout isn't reducing stress. It's managing your energy. Next from Fast Company, an article entitled, "This is Why High Performers Crave Feedback." Watch any Olympic event and you'll notice this universal ritual. The moment an athlete completes their performance, they turn to their coach for feedback. There's no defensiveness, just a hunger to know how to improve. They understand that even the smallest adjustment could be the difference between standing on the podium or watching from the sidelines. For athletes, feedback is not criticism. It's a tool for enhancement. This mindset isn't confined to sports. High performers in every field, whether that's business, academia, or the arts, share an insatiable appetite for actionable feedback. It's their secret weapon for continual improvement. Why feedback fuels growth? Feedback often gets a bad reputation. Many people mistakenly view it as a critique of past performance or decisions. But reframing feedback as an investment in future growth shifts that narrative. High achievers don't see it as an attack on their abilities. Rather, they see it as an opportunity to elevate their performance. In organizations, feedback takes many forms. Executives refining leadership skills through a 360-degree review, entrepreneurs tweaking pitches after investor input, or creatives honing their craft with input from trusted peers. The best performers seek it proactively, seeing it as their competitive edge. They don't just ask for feedback, they act on it. Here are some lessons that we can take from how high performers see feedback. First, feedback is a collaboration, not a criticism. Olympians focus on improvement, not excuses. Scott Hamilton, Olympic champion figure skater, shared with me the wise words his coach told him. Never give excuses. Offer reasons. Excuses stall growth, Hamilton explained, but reasons illuminate areas for adjustment. Similarly, Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella emphasizes the value of being a learn-it-all over a know-it-all. This echoes psychologist Carol Dweck's work on mindsets. Individuals with a growth mindset embrace feedback as a fuel for improvement, while those with a fixed mindset see that as a threat. High performers treat feedback as a collaborative effort to refine their skills, not a critique of their character. Next, small adjustments can lead to big impact. Feedback doesn't have to mean an overwhelming overhaul. Often, it's minor tweaks, changing the tone of a presentation, adjusting priorities in a project that lead to the biggest breakthroughs. Next, don't wait for feedback, ask for it. High performers actively seek feedback instead of waiting for annual reviews or chance encounters. By asking for input, they demonstrate curiosity and a commitment to growth. People are often eager to help those who genuinely want to improve. When seeking feedback, specificity is key. Instead of asking, "Do you have any feedback?" try, "What one thing could I do to make this presentation more engaging?" Clear, targeted questions yield actionable insights. Next, feedback is a continuous process. Annual performance reviews aren't enough. That's because feedback is most effective in two forms. First, reflection in action. Immediate insights during the task, like an Olympian receiving real-time coaching from their coach on the sidelines during a competition. And then reflection on action, deliberate analysis after the fact, such as a debriefing, a major presentation to identify lessons for the future. Next, turn feedback into action. Over time, this continuous feedback loop drives incremental changes that compound into significant growth. To integrate feedback effectively, high performers follow these five strategies. 1. Ask specific questions. Shift from vague to precise. Instead of "how am I doing," ask, "what's one way I can make this project more impactful?" or "what is an idea I should consider to shorten my time to closing a deal?" 2. Build a feedback network. Seek diverse perspectives from managers, peers, clients, and stakeholders. Each offers unique insights. For example, ask, "what can I do to make this communication clearer?" 3. Normalize feedback in teams. Foster a culture of regular informal feedback. You can use after-action reviews, common in the military and healthcare, to refine processes and achieve better outcomes. When it becomes part of the tapestry of the organization, people learn to expect it. If you do it right, it offers an opportunity to extract a lesson from one event and then use it in another. 4. Act quickly. Show that you value input by implementing feedback as quickly as possible. Close the loop with the person who shared it. Explain what you've changed or why you chose not to, which demonstrates intentional thought. And 5. Reflect and adjust. Self-reflection is as critical as external input. Review your work, look for areas of improvement, and experiment with new approaches. Consider recording yourself, practicing in front of a mirror, or viewing your performance from the perspective of key stakeholders. Reframing feedback as a growth tool. Every project, like every athlete's performance, is an experiment, a chance to refine and improve. By reframing feedback as an enabler of professional success, not a critique of abilities, you unlock the potential for lasting achievement. Olympians rely on their coaches to fine-tune their performance. In the same way, embracing feedback with a growth mindset transforms high potential into high performance. In our next article, what brands can learn from the Super Bowl ads we're all still talking about. Ad campaigns that leave the biggest impact, like those from Poppies and Carl's Jr., are the ones that go beyond the screen. Super Bowl ad spots range from just 15 to 60 seconds, but their impact lives on through social media for the days, weeks, and sometimes even years that follow. Although around 50 brands brought broadcast time, less than a week later, only a handful are still being talked about. So how can brands best transform their very expensive ads from momentary entertainment to long-lasting conversation pieces? Data from Metricool, a social media analytics tool, shows that the Super Bowl ads with the largest reach and impact are ones that use social media to turn their seconds-long time slot into an all-encompassing experience. Brands should focus on full-scope coverage rather than putting all their eggs in a TV ad, says Aniston Ward, a specialist at Metricool. It takes a full experience to really create a lasting effect. Poppy's influencer marketing tactic, for one example, scaled beyond its brief TV spot to make a lasting post-Super Bowl impact. In the week leading up to the big game, the health-focused soda brand launched a series of giveaways, collaborations with influencers, and a high-profile stunt involving the brand sending neon pink branded vending machines to more than 30 influencers. Days later, people are still talking about Poppy's tactics, though not all of the reception has been positive. Many online called Poppy out of touch for giving large amounts of free product to already wealthy influencers. And now Poppy is in everyone's mouths, whether it's good or bad, Ward says. Metricool observed that Poppy's Instagram engagement reached 4%, which might seem a paltry figure, but Instagram's industry average is 0.7%, and anything higher than 1% is considered a strong performance. The brand's Instagram post likely spiked nearly 100%. Carl's Jr. also turned its Super Bowl ad spend into a week-long online experience, featuring a scantily dressed Alex Earl biting into Carl's Jr.'s Hangover Burger to promote a free burger day on February 10th. The company shared behind-the-scenes footage leading up to the Super Bowl Sunday and even released a snippet of the ad on Reels the Wednesday before the game. That reel secured a fast food restaurant chain a 91% increase in Instagram followers and a 47% engagement rate, the top engagement of any Super Bowl social media promotion. When an ad campaign is successful, the conversation around it can last for weeks. For Apple, the conversation's been going on for decades. Yes, more than 40 years later, Apple's 1984 ad, which redefined Super Bowl commercials and permanently launched the company into the international spotlight, still sets the bar for branding brilliance. Last year's best-performing Super Bowl spot also garnered international attention. Beyoncé's announcement of her Cowboy Carter album in a collaboration with Verizon is still receiving a positive ripple effect today. The album broke Spotify records upon its release, and Beyoncé paired up with Verizon yet again this year to announce her Cowboy Carter tour. The Super Bowl is one of the largest marketing events of the year, Ward says. It can give us a footprint to how marketers can craft their campaigns for the next year and use it as a kind of reference to what has worked well. Next, ChatGPT's latest feature is a transformative leap for web research. By scouring the web rather than just relying on a large language model, deep research comes up with far better results than plain old AI bots. I'm not sure who first compared ChatGPT to Cliff Clavin, the garrulous mailbag barfly from TV's Cheers. It's so an apt comparison that many people probably came up with it independently. Cliff did know a lot of stuff, after all. He was a Jeopardy almost winner. Yet he was also a blowhard who didn't seem to realize when he was speaking outside the bounds of his expertise. If you were paying attention, you knew that his seeming level of confidence was unrelated to the value of what he had to say. Even as AI companies have managed to reduce their chatbot's tendency to hallucinate, a certain degree of Clavinism has remained endemic to the category. But I've been playing with a new ChatGPT feature called Deep Research, which OpenAI announced last week. Instead of just being glib and eager to please, it weaves together facts and analysis into results with real substance. It's not perfect, but it ranks with Google's Notebook LM among the most impressive AI research tools that I've tried. I don't believe I've encountered a single hallucination in the tens of thousands of words it generated in response to my queries thus far. At the moment, taking advantage of deep research requires deep pockets. The feature is debuting as part of ChatGPT Pro, which costs $200 a month. If further testing goes as expected, OpenAI says it will come down to the $20 per month ChatGPT Plus in a month or so. Once it does, I expect to use it frequently. OpenAI's blog post about deep research offers background on how it works, accompanied by charts showing its performance in various AI benchmarks. In use, what feels like is a new kind of chatbot that actually does its homework, far less dependent on a hermetically sealed LLM than most. It comes up with an answer to a question in something closer to the way a human research assistant would, by consulting sources around the web in real time and synthesizing them into a cohesive whole. It's a much more fleshed out, immediately useful example of agnetic AI than Operator, another recently introduced ChatGPT feature that's able to trawl the web on its users' behalf. By human standards, deep research does its work swiftly, but it's hardly instantaneous. OpenAI says to expect the process to take 5 to 30 minutes per query. As it chugs away, it usually displays a running list of notes. For example, following a request I made involving fast food history, it noted search for McDonald's, number of location in the 1960s. Once in a while, these snippets are mystifying non sequiturs. At one point, it told me, if necessary, I will escalate to HR for guidance. Overall, however, they make the feat of generating AI text feel less like magic trick and more like a computational process we mere mortals might actually comprehend, a welcome change from AI's often opaque nature. I threw a bunch of projects at deep research, such as writing a competitive analysis of the market for image editing software, explaining how mechanical watches work, comparing instant photography technologies from Polaroid and Kodak, and chronicling attempts to suppress free speech in the U.S. from 1900 to 1950. In every instance, it came back with a detailed response full of well-chosen facts and crisp analysis, on a different plane of readability and quality than standard AI bot fare. It also provided Wikipedia-like citations for its work, a boon for full disclosure and an aid to further reading on the subject. Impressive though deep research is, certain types of requests revealed its weak spots. As with most generative AI bots, it has relentlessly positive attitude that gets in the way of anything requiring critical appraisal. I tried to get it to be more blunt by asking about the most forgettable pop culture pap imaginable, and it always insisted everything was a cult favorite. And while OpenAI touts the feature as being able to provide hyper-personalized recommendation on purchases that typically require careful research, the more I knew about a product area, the less impressed I was by its advice. Its suggestion of cameras for street photography, for example, were muddled by some prices that were way, way off. And I asked it about tablets capable of replacing a laptop. It waxed enthusiastic about the 2022 iPad Pros, apparently unaware that Apple replaced them last year. Thanks to the feature's running notes and citations, some of its other current limitations are obvious. For instance, it often tried to read sources that might have been valuable, such as Consumer Reports, and gave up because they were paywalled. It also doesn't seem to perform what I wouldn't consider truly dazzling feats of online derring-do, such as a phishing material out of an obscure PDF salted away in the Internet Archive's many nooks and crannies. OpenAI's blog post announcement mentions expansion plans that encompass specialized data sources and subscription-based resources, implying that deep research could get meaningfully better without requiring foundational advances on its AI. Oh, and one other thing. It kept asking me if I'd like its answers to include charts and diagrams. I always said yes, but it never provided any. It would be nice if it eventually got this option it mistakenly believes it already has. In 1984, the famously demanding technologist and visionary Alan Kay deemed the original Macintosh to be the first personal computer good enough to be worth criticizing. Even with its current rough edges, deep research might be the first general-purpose AI-enhanced research tool to clear that bar, both a breakthrough right now and, with any luck, a preview of even better things to come. Our next article is from Fortune magazine. Forget about return to office. Companies are getting distracted with mandates and screwing up these five core work practices. It's hard not to notice the massive return-to-office push taking over corporate America. Many of the largest Fortune 500 companies, including Amazon, AT&T, JP Morgan, and Dell, have recently required workers to come back to the office 5 days per week. And just a few weeks ago, President Trump released an executive action requiring federal workers to return to the office full-time or look for employment elsewhere. The number of workers going into the office at least 4 days per week rose from 34% in 2023 to 68% in 2024, according to new research from consulting firm McKinsey & Company. Meanwhile, the number of people working remotely for four or more days plunged from 44% to 17% during the same time period. Leaders in both the public and private sectors claim similar reasons for this push. Employees are not as productive working from home as they are in the office, but the survey challenges that belief. It found that insisting on where employees work is actually far less important than the environment leaders create. Companies that hope to reach their stated organizational effectiveness goals should look beyond RTO policies themselves to address the chronic problems that continue to take a toll on employee experience and productivity, says Brooke Wheadle, a senior partner at McKinsey. There's not a lot of daylight between satisfaction rates of workers that are mostly remote or workers that are mostly in person, and quit rates for both groups, which measure an employee's intention to leave, are around 39%. Burnout rates are also high across all types of flexible work groups, 36% for remote workers, 35% for in-person, and 28% for hybrid. Instead of focusing on location, McKinsey singles out five core practices that define a strong workplace: collaboration, connectivity, innovation, mentorship, and skill development. Critically, employees across remote, hybrid, and in-person work categories didn't show any gap larger than 9 percentage points when it came to grading their organization in these categories. In short, it's not about where employees work. It's about what workplaces do to improve their cultural pillars. Successful organizations can improve on these five practices by increasing the intentional time managers and senior leaders spend with employees and making sure that employees receive regular check-ins, according to the report. Outside HR leaders agree. RTO is not a silver bullet for engagement and performance, key Anna Schmeidel, Chief Human Experience Officer at HR software company WorkHuman, tells Fortune about the McKinsey's report's findings. Mutual trust, personalized recognition, frequent one-on-one check-ins, opportunities for growth and development, these are the key drivers of a performance and well-being. Next from Fortune, an article entitled "The White Collar Recession is Pummeling Office Workers, but the End Might Be Near." Whether it's the dull water cooler talk, the shine of fluorescent lights, or the constant threat of layoffs, white collar work is draped in such a dreary fog that Adam Scott has been called to act out the general malaise of the workforce in the popular Apple television series Severance. But there might be a light at the end of the tunnel for corporate drudgery. I don't think that the plight of the high-end mid-level professional is ever going to go away, but we do see green shoots on the horizon, Korn Ferry's Mike DiStanfo, who leads professional search and interim placements at the organizational consulting firm, tells Fortune, adding that change is afoot on the job market. Indeed, people in office jobs have recently gone through some upheaval. In the shadow of prosperity during the early pandemic, one in four U.S. workers who lost their jobs last year were white-collared professionals, writes S&P Global, adding that it's a possible sign the industry may be straining under the weight of high interest rates and that technological advances may already be making some workers obsolete. And those who are looking for new options report an arduous and frustrating job search. A whopping 40% of applicants say that they didn't land a single job interview in all of 2024, according to a survey of more than 2,000 respondents by the American Staffing Association and the Harris Poll. Facing a swing back of benefits and relative flexibility, many white-collar workers are left feeling stagnant and disengaged, a phenomenon dubbed the Great Detachment by Gallup. Everybody wants to make it to 65 and get the watch and the retirement party, but I think that has been a fallacy for the past couple of generations and probably will continue to be so as we move forward, noting that we've been sitting in this malaise for up to 2 years. Although it appears as if the pendulum might finally be swinging back in the employee's favor, searches from nearly every function and industry have picked up over the past couple of months, and the pipeline for new business remains encouraging, says DiStefanso, slightly facetiously adding that he's seen more activity in the past 30 days than the past 30 months. Do I think that people have been waiting patiently to make a move over the past couple of years? Sure, he muses, adding that many people feel burned out from doing more with less and not necessarily feeling like they're getting the financial rewards commensurate with their activity. He asserts, though, that it's all just indicative of where we are in the cycle. At the end of the drought comes the rain. The rise of workers' leverage appears to be on the horizon, too, though power is currently firmly clamped in the hands of the bosses. DiStefano points to a couple of factors fueling potential shift, including pent-up demand following a cloud of anxiety regarding an official recession, the slow but sure reduction of interest rates, a high-performing stock market, and a change in administration. It's too early to tell how the volatility of President Trump's administration will impact this all, but from simply a business productivity lens, there's hope of greater federal investment into the economy. Clocking where we are right now as a buyer's market, he says that things are a bit up in the air as organizations are scratching their heads regarding the true impact of AI and their future needs. Korn Ferry's recommendations to anybody, regardless of where they are in their career, is you've got to be one step ahead, he says, of the challenging market. Adding in the challenge is aligning your skills to where the new jobs and demand might be. That might be harder for white-collar employees already decades into their career who have been spurned by this era of work. While hiring rates remain steady for those who earn less than $55,000 annually, it reached new lows for those who make over $96,000, according to a 2024 report from Vanguard. In 2023, hiring for middle and top third earning employees dwindled so much that the latter group reached the lowest level of hiring since 2014. While we don't believe there will be massive upswing in demand for mid-level professional talent in the near future, we do believe there will be a steady stream of turnover and new additions driven by prolonged postponements and pent-up growth initiatives slowly being implemented. In the meantime, he suggests that middle-aged adults in white-collar workforce stay fresh by networking, always having contingency plans, and being up to date on their skills. The demand in this current market is for experts, not generalists, he adds. Even so, the momentum feels like it's coming back. I believe brighter days are ahead. Again, turning to Fortune magazine, doctors reveal 7 strategies they use themselves to live longer and healthier lives. Lifespan has been a big topic in health for decades, but over the past few years, it's been replaced by a focus on health span. While lifespan is simply about living longer, health span focuses on the part of a person's life where they're considered to be in good health. Unfortunately, data show that Americans have some work to do around health span. A study published in the Journal of American Medical Association Network Open in December analyzed data on the gap between health span and lifespan from 183 World Health Organization member states. Researchers discovered that Americans had the largest gap of 12.4 years. By comparison, the global mean health span to lifespan gap globally was just 9.6 years. While the news isn't great for people living in the U.S., doctors stress that it is important for Americans to focus on health span. We focus so much on lifespan and trying to live longer, but we sometimes fail to understand that the quality of life we have, even if it is extended, is just as if not more important, says Dr. Barbara Bauer, a family medicine physician at The Ohio State University. Health span is how we can prolong our healthy years, where we avoid illness and diseases and can therefore live an active, healthy, and happy life. Your health span isn't predetermined. There are things you can do to increase it. I really believe in working to improve health span, says Linda E. Crowley, PhD, interim director for the UCLA Longevity Center. I've been doing it since before the term health span was coined. Health is a broad area, and everyone approaches health span differently. With that in mind, we tapped 7 researchers and doctors who work with aging patients to learn more about what they do to improve their own health span. Here's what they shared. I take all of my vacation days. Bauer notes the importance of reducing stress when it comes to health span, given that stress is linked to a higher risk of developing several diseases, including heart disease, obesity, and high blood pressure. She has several ways of trying to minimize chronic stress in her life. One is making sure to take time off from work to relax when it's available. I take all of my vacation days, she says. We are horrible at this as a country, and we need it, and we deserve it, and we're entitled to it. Even if you just have a staycation, setting aside designated time to get things done or relax is crucial. I do this yearly, she adds. Bauer also tries to practice forgiveness to her lower stress levels. Holding on to stress and something someone else did to you will only affect you, likely not that person. And after that initial episode, she says, so let it go. Thankfulness can also be helpful, she says. Remind yourself to be thankful for what you have, what you have done, and who you are, and let the rest go. I've incorporated a significant amount of plants into my diet. Studies have consistently linked plant-based diets to a lower risk of heart disease, diabetes, cancer, and other serious health conditions. That's prompted John Fudumaya, MD, clinical associate professor of medicine and the interim chief of the Division of General Internal Medicine at the Jacobs School, to focus on adding plenty of plant-based foods to his meals. I've incorporated a significant amount of plants into my diet, he says, noting that he tries to fill 3/4 of his plate with plants at every meal. I try to have as many plants as possible, eating a variety of vegetables, fruits, nuts, and grains, and has stopped eating red meat, which has been associated with a higher risk of developing heart disease, cancer, diabetes, and premature death. On occasion, I'll have poultry for holidays, but I'm more of a pescatarian, he says. I make recipe tweaks. Eating a healthy diet is also important. To Dr. Lindley, the associate professor of medicine and director of the Women Health Center at Vanderbilt University. For her, that means focusing on having plenty of fruits and vegetables, lean meats like chicken and fish, low-fat dairy and whole grains. Avoiding excess sugars, sweetened beverages, and processed foods can go a really long way for long-term health, she says. But she also tries to make her recipes better by tweaking certain ingredients. You can often pretty easily make a recipe healthier by making some simple changes, such as substituting ground turkey for ground beef, using an air fryer instead of deep frying, or increasing the amount of beans or vegetables in the recipe, she says. I try to follow basic health advice. The steps to try to achieve good health span are simple for Dr. Talia, professor and chair in the Department of Family Medicine at Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. You've heard them all before. Don't smoke, don't drink alcohol to excess or even at all, don't overeat, but eat healthy and non-processed foods, and of course, the biggie, stay active and exercise. Talia also makes a point to see his family physician regularly to stay on top of his health and to be screened for potential health issues like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and diabetes, so he can treat any problems that pop up early. Following these steps means doing everything that's in your control to maximize your health span to make it consistent with your lifespan. I exercise every morning. Every morning I hike and run and bike or lift weights. Sometimes I swim. I try to do as many activities as I can. Mandelbaum says it's important for him to enjoy exercises, and he tries to actively to fuel his lifestyle. These exercises require strength, balance, and coordination. You have to have it all for health span. He also tries to mix up his workouts to target a range of muscles and to lower the risk of injury. You can't have a bad knee or weak muscles and hike up a hill, Mandelbaum says. You're only as strong as your weakest link. Research has also found that mixing up activities can lower the risk of falls, which are the leading cause of disability and death in older adults. I focus on the quality of my sleep. I take relationships very seriously. The U.S. Surgeon General recently emphasized that the need for social connection, noting that it's an underappreciated factor in health span. Research also finds that being socially active can help people live longer. That's one of the reasons why relationships are such a focus for Dr. Kaiser, a geriatrician and director of geriatric cognitive health for the Pacific Neuroscience Institute. When you look at health longevity, perhaps the most important factor is the quality of our relationships, he says. I really try to prioritize relationships as much as other aspects of my life, like getting a good night's sleep, healthy eating, and exercise. He notes that the work can be all-consuming, but he still makes time to connect with friends and loved ones when he's not seeing patients. Even the busiest person inevitably has free time at some point, he says. Using that free time to make sure you're fostering that connectivity quotient as well is super important.